natives had merely disappeared after the Germans had arrived. And yet, it never occurred to her to doubt his words. They had the ring of truth, and they chilled her to the bone. She found her voice, somehow.
What happened to you?
Oh, they never trusted me after that,
Grandpa Frank said.
I had betrayed the Volk, you see, by making love to a Jewess. There was no hope of promotion. I took early retirement and went back to Berlin. Your grandmother was kind enough to marry me. I never told her the truth, of course, even when my nightmares drove her out of bed. We had the nastiest arguments before she fell pregnant and left her job. And then she died 4 years after your mother was born. I brought her up on my own. Never married again, either.
He let go of Gudrun's wrist.
Every time I close my eyes, I see her face,
he muttered, reaching for the bottle.
If I remain drunk all the time, it helps. I keep thinking about killing myself. But what good would that do?
I don't know,
Gudrun said. It had been easy to dismiss Grandpa Frank when he'd just been a disgusting old man. Now she wasn't sure what to think.
But what else can you do?
I was taught that suicide was a mortal sin,
Grandpa Frank said.
And yet, surely, what we did in the Einsatzgruppen was even worse. We told ourselves that they were subhuman. We told ourselves that we were strong, and they were weak, and the strong had rights to use the weak as they saw fit. We told ourselves that their mere existence was a threat to the Reich, that they had to be destroyed to save ourselves from certain destruction. And yet, after what I did, I can no longer believe it.
His voice trailed off.
You wrote that leaflet,
Grandpa Frank said.
And you could possibly pass for a BDM girl if you wore your uniform and kept your eyes downcast.
I did,
Gudrun confirmed. There was no point in trying to deny it.
Grandpa,
the state isn't going to let you get away with it,
Grandpa Frank hissed.
They've buried so many would-be reformers over the years. Don't ever underestimate how far they're prepared to go to root out all opposition to their rule. But don't stop. Don't let them get away with it.
He leaned back in his bed.
I told myself there was nothing I could do,
he whispered as he closed his eyes.
And at the time, maybe I was right.
Gudrun waited, her heart pounding in her chest, but he said nothing else. She checked his breathing. For a moment, she thought he'd finally let go of life and surrendered to death, and then relaxed as she realized it was stable. Rising to her feet, she walked out the door and headed down to her room. Suddenly, the threat of her father's anger seemed unimportant compared to what she'd been told. She felt sick to even consider her grandfather having an affair with anyone. But he wasn't an old man at the time, she told herself, as she closed the door behind her. There was no point in locking it, and sat down on the bed.
He wouldn't have been much older than Kurt.
Her thoughts were so jumbled up that it was a relief when she heard someone tapping at the door. She braced herself, grimly prepared to take whatever punishment her father decided to mete out, then blinked in surprise as Kurt opened the door and stepped into the room. He was holding the leaflet in one hand.
You may as well read it, he said as he closed the door. I managed to talk Father out of beating you, but it would probably be better if you didn't show your face until tomorrow.
Gudrun swallowed.
Thank you,
she said as she took the leaflet. It was identical to the leaflets she'd handed out only a few hours ago.
What did you say to him?
Told him you'd jump to the worst possible conclusion because that's what girls do, Kurt said. He ignored the rude gesture she aimed at him. And that you probably thought Conrad was mentioned by name. He lowered his voice.
You're playing a dangerous game, Gudrun.
I know, Gudrun said. She looked up at him.
Are you going to betray me?
How could I without revealing that I sneaked into the hospital beside you? Kurt asked, dryly. You couldn't have done it without me.
That was true, Gudrun knew. But betraying the person who'd helped write and distribute the leaflets would probably have won him forgiveness. He wasn't a student, after all. He was a Berlin guardsman, who was probably bound for South Africa soon.
Thank you, she said instead. I'm not going to stop.
I know, Kurt said. You're as stubborn as father.
And if I wasn't a girl, he'd have something to be proud of, Gudrun snarled.
He's had a bad day, Kurt reminded her. The girls he had to round up would have been very like you. Some of them might only be a year or two younger. He didn't join the police for that.
Gudrun shrugged as her brother patted her on the shoulder and rose, heading for the door. As far as she could tell, the order police were intended to push people around. Why else would anyone join up?
Get some rest, Kurt advised. You have to go back to university tomorrow.
I know, Gudrun said. Thank you.
Chapter 16. Reichstag, Berlin. 28 July, 1985. It was not, Hans Kruger decided, going to be a particularly pleasant meeting. He'd been expecting a vote on the deployment of additional troops to South Africa. His sources had told him that the SS was trying to strike a deal with the military and had been preparing for a long argument when the news about the protest leaflets reached the Ministry of Finance, followed by an urgent demand for an immediate meeting. He'd obtained one of the leaflets from the security office, read it while walking to the Reichstag, and made his way up to the central meeting room. The others had already arrived and were seated around the table.
This is a crisis, Carl Holliston said.
The Reichsführer SS had one of the leaflets unfolded in front of him and was glowering down at it.
Someone spread seditious propaganda in Berlin itself and escaped.
Hans took a seat, forcing himself to remain calm. The SS and the other security forces would be embarrassed, if not humiliated, by the whole affair. He didn't blame them. It was physically impossible for them to patrol the entire Reich, let alone maintain a level of omnipresence second only to God's. Their control rested on fear, rested on the population believing that they might be under surveillance at any moment, that anything they said might be recorded and used in evidence against them at a later date. To have someone, or a small group of traitors, pull off such a coup in the center of Berlin would call their capabilities into doubt.
Let us not turn this molehill into a mountain, he said, as he dropped his own copy of the leaflet on the table. Annoying as this is, it is a very minor issue. Any defiance of the Reich is a major issue, Holliston snapped. By now, copies of this damnable tissue of lies are spreading through the city.
Hans frowned.
They are? Yes, Holliston said. Apparently, a number of copies were dropped into letterboxes all over Berlin. We've had at least a dozen handed into the local police. This is not an isolated act of protest, but a calculated strike against the authority of the Reich.
So we track down the people responsible and eliminate them, Field Marshal Justus Stoffregen said. That should not be too difficult.
It may not be that easy, Hans said.
He hadn't had long to think about the implications, but he was a veteran of countless political wars.
We need to treat this very carefully. We need to stamp on these traitors as hard as we can, Holliston insisted.
It isn't that simple, Hans said. How many leaflets were not handed in to the police?
He pressed on before anyone could try to answer an unanswerable question.
This leaflet urges people to ask questions about other soldiers who have dropped out of contact, neither writing to their families nor returning home on leave, he said.
How many civilians in Berlin have relatives in South Africa, relatives who have seemingly vanished because we have not told their families about their conditions? It will not be long before people start putting together the full story.
They are not encouraged to ask questions, Holliston said.
Hans gave him a sharp look. You plan to keep two mothers from talking about the children? Or two housewives from worrying about their husbands? Right now, I imagine, word is spreading, no matter what we do about it. There's no way we can deny everything and expect to be believed.
Radio Berlin can tell the Reich that the leaflets are talking nonsense,
Holliston insisted. But they're not talking nonsense, Hans snapped back, and the population will know they're not talking nonsense.
Then we tell the population that the soldiers died in a good cause,
Holliston said.
We shift our policy to honoring the dead and tending to the wounded.
That would add credence to the leaflet's claims, Field Marshal Günter Voss said. It would also make it look like we are allowing these rebels to dictate our actions. Holliston scowled at him angrily.
And they also want free elections to the Reichstag, he said. Are we going to tamely surrender power?
We could give them what they want, Hans pointed out. The Reichstag hasn't had any real power since 1944.
The Nazi Party has governed this country since 1931, Holliston said. In 54 years, we have risen to a position of global dominance our forefathers couldn't possibly have imagined. Our armies are the strongest in the world. Our settlers are turning the wastelands of Russia and the Middle East into new civilizations. There's no reason to give power to a bunch of whining civilians who have done nothing to earn it.
Hans frowned inwardly. There was a certain degree of social mobility in the Reich, either through the military, the SS, or the Nazi Party bureaucracy. He'd started out as a young bureaucrat after all, and Holliston, to give the devil his due, had been a brave stormtrooper who'd seen genuine action. But the odds of anyone reaching the Reich Council were staggeringly low, and by the time they actually reached high office, they would be so thoroughly ingrained with the ideals of their particular branch that they'd have trouble seeing anyone else's point of view. There were far too many bureaucrats, after all, who couldn't understand why small businesses were complaining about the tax burden.
I think we have to admit, he said slowly, that everything has just changed.
He tapped the leaflet with one finger.
We have been using trickery to hide the fact that the death rate in South Africa is alarmingly high. And that isn't the only thing we've been trying to hide. The state of our economy...
To hell with the economy,
Holliston thundered.
That's precisely where it's going, Hans said mildly. We have been robbing Peter to pay Paul for the last decade, using the loot from our conquests and our captive markets to paper over the cracks in the system. Now we are running out of time. Now people are going to be asking questions. Now our reaction to those questions will only give the charges against us,
he tapped the leaflet again,
more credence. You know as well as I do that people talk. That word is going to spread through the Reich.
He forced himself to calm down with an effort.
And you ordered the BDM girls to be corralled in the square, he added. Just how many mothers do you think you panicked when they heard that their little girls were under arrest?
Those girls were helping to spread these damnable leaflets, Holliston said.
There isn't a shred of evidence that the official BDM girls were doing anything other than handing out the standard propaganda leaflets, Hans said.
That might have been a lucky break. He'd long suspected that no one actually bothered to read the leaflets, no matter what they might have been told at school.
They're not Jews, Karl. You can't arrest, even for a couple of hours, 57 schoolgirls and expect no one to comment on it.
I suggest, Voss said, that we focus on the issue at hand. Do we have any leads at all?
We're working on it, Holliston said. There have been some clashes between the different organizations involved in securing Berlin. The SS should take the lead, but the Gestapo and the Order Police think differently. I propose that the SS should formally take command of the counter-rebel operation.
Hans frowned. The SS had lost control of the order police in the 50s, after Himmler had overreached himself. No one outside the SS, and quite a few factions within the SS, had been keen to see Himmler in sole control of the security services. And he wasn't blind to the implications of handing Carl Holliston so much power. He'd take what he could, and then make it permanent, perhaps even using it to boost himself into supreme power. Had he even started handing out the leaflets in the first place? Hans wouldn't have put the thought past him. And he may think I started it, he thought morbidly. But neither of us really wants to undermine the Reich itself.
We can discuss that later, he said. What do we know? The leaflets were distributed by at least 3 girls, all wearing BDM uniforms, Holliston said. Only a couple of the witnesses were paying close attention. One reported a girl with long dark hair. Another insisted he'd seen a blonde with a very large chest.
The witness was a teenage boy, I assume, Voss said. Hans fought to hide his smile. Could easily have been a middle-aged man, he pointed out. Was it?
It was a soldier home from the wars, Holliston said curtly. As far as we can tell, all of the BDM girls who were trapped within the square were linked to matrons, so we believe that the fakes left the square before the alert was sounded and made their escape into the city. So far, we do not have any leads on just who spread the rest of the leaflets, but we are working on it. There aren't, however, many places the leaflets could have been printed.
Voss took the leaflet from the table and inspected it. The paper's softer, he said. Not absorbent enough to be useful, unfortunately, but it isn't a perfect copy. Holliston gave him a sharp look.
A small printing shop could have done it, he said, and we will follow them. However, the most likely place where the leaflets were produced is the university.
Hans swore under his breath. Holliston had always hated the university, hated how it brought American ideals into even a relatively small population of students. And yet, it was necessary. No one knew better than Hans just how badly the Reich was falling apart, just how desperately they needed to reinvigorate their technological base. The students might be the only thing capable of saving the Reich from itself.
We shut the university down, Holliston continued, and investigate all the students for seditious leanings.
That would do a great deal of damage to our already weakened economy, Hans pointed out tartly. The computer network alone would be badly hampered if we refused to allow university-taught experts to work on it. And without that...
Our forefathers didn't have a computer network, Holliston snapped.
They weren't facing anyone who did, either, Hans countered. The Americans have been leveraging their computer network and using it as the base for a whole new series of technological developments. If we shut our network down, as sparse as it is compared to the American design, we might as well shoot ourselves in the head and save time.
And yet, we have to buy computers off the Americans, Holliston said. How do we know we can even trust them?
The university will give us better computers in time, Hans said. It was an old argument, but the truth was that the United States had moved far ahead, reverse engineering some of the more advanced machines the Reich had obtained from the U.S., had proved impossible, while what computers the Reich could produce were unsellable outside the Reich's captive market. We just need to give it time to flourish.
You've been saying that for 5 years, Holliston reminded him.
And what use, Hans asked, could one get out of a 5-year-old child?
I think we're moving away from the point, Voss said. We don't have time to bicker when we need to come up with a response to these leaflets.
That is correct, Field Marshal Stoffregen said. Allow me to suggest a compromise.
Hans exchanged a look with Holliston, then nodded.
Finding these rebels and rooting them out is a priority, Stoffregen continued smoothly.
Military officer or not, he wouldn't have reached high office without being a skilled politician.
At the same time, we have no proof that the university is involved in the affair.
and we do need the university. Therefore, I propose that we do not act overtly against the university, but we also place control of the affair in the hands of the SS. This would, of course, be a short-term measure.
That would be acceptable, Holliston said after a moment. But we do need to tighten up security, both on the university campus itself and the streets.
And you'll do your level best to make it a long-term measure, Hans thought coldly. The hell of it was that he doubted he could argue against the suggestion. They would leave the university in peace, at least for the moment, in exchange for a short-term surrender of power to the SS. And you can use that to take over the university, or shut it down, given time.
Putting additional policemen on the streets might be a good idea, he said carefully. I would insist, however, that your people within the university be carefully trained in recognizing the difference between student chatter and actual sedition. There's no time to train up additional agents, Holliston said. He leaned forward. A strong and visible presence may deter students from joining the movement, even if it doesn't lead to any of the ringleaders.
Who may not even be students at all, Hans snapped.
He didn't fault Holliston for jumping to such a conclusion, but there was no proof. A cell within the Nazi party itself could have produced the leaflets, then arranged to have them handed out. It wasn't beyond belief that some of his subordinates had actually decided to take matters into their own hands. It was hard enough to build the university, Carl. We don't want it wrecked overnight.
There's no need to import Americanisms, Holliston sneered. We have always been at our strongest when we go back to basics.
There's nothing basic about a panzer tank, Hans snapped. There's nothing basic about a radio, or vaccinations, or man-portable anti-aircraft missiles. And the Americans are already ahead of us. How long will it be before they come up with something that gives them an unbeatable advantage?
You don't know that will happen, Holliston said.
I doubt Frederick the Great could have predicted the arrival of panzers, Hans pointed out sharply. And even if he had, could he have stopped the dozen panzers from ripping his army into little pieces?
We need to vote, Field Marshal Stauffregen said, before Holliston could come up with a biting retort. All those in favor?
It was, Carl Holliston conceded afterwards, a bitter victory. He was not fool enough to believe, despite the prospects for winning the endless struggle for power in the Reich, that Hans Kruger was responsible for the leaflets, or for aiding and abetting their producers. Kruger, whatever his faults, wouldn't risk the fundamental balance of power that controlled the Reich. And that, Carl was sure, was true of everyone else who had a seat on the Reich Council. They simply had far too much to lose if social upheaval swept through the Reich. But they were soft, and that softness was going to get them killed. It had to be the university, he was sure. The SS, the military, even the party bureaucracy, none of them would tolerate the kind of free thinkers it would take to gather the evidence, produce the leaflets, and then distribute them to the masses. They'd have problems even recognizing that the masses could be politically important. Hell, they weren't politically important. What did it matter if some workers wanted to form an independent union, or some housewives started demanding more rights, or school children wanted an end to the harsh discipline and relentless tutoring? There was nothing they could do about it, was there? Carl had studied universities in America, back when he'd been mustering his objections to the whole concept. Yes, they did encourage the development of new technological ideas. He'd never tried to deny that. But they also encouraged the spread of political ideas. And some of those ideas could be very dangerous. The current racial melange that made up the United States was partly the work of American students, who'd fought to embrace Untermenschen to their bosom. Good German girls wouldn't even think of allowing themselves to be sullied by an Untermensch. American girls didn't think twice about dating and even marrying Untermenschen men. the Americans didn't even seem to realize just how badly they were damaging their own society. And Japan is the worst of America, Carl thought. It still made him shudder every time he thought about just how deeply the races had blended together, just how the once proud white stock that had tamed America had been diluted by the intrusion of Japanese blood. They will not be allowed to spread their perversions over here. But it had to be the university students, he told himself. No other group in Germany could combine an awareness of their surroundings with a political naivety that would urge them to try to spread the word. There was simply no one else so foolish, so free of the ever-present listening ears. And besides, if students could cause long-term political damage in America, perhaps they would think they could do the same in the Third Reich. He kept his face expressionless as the meeting finally came to an end, giving him the chance to hurry back to his office. The Gestapo and the order police, for once, would have to take orders from the SS, orders that would lead them right to the rebels. And if the rebels proved harder to find than he expected, it might be time to start coming up with some contingency plans, he thought. Silently, he started drawing up some possible concepts. Plans that will stamp on the rebels once and for all. Chapter 17. Berlin, 29 July, 1985.
Do you all understand your objectives? Leutnant der Polizei Hermann Wielen nodded hastily. He'd gone into the station after the acrimonious family dinner, only to be told to bed down in the barracks and wait for orders along with the rest of his squad. By the time they'd been awoken and told to shower, shave, and get into fresh uniforms, it was the following morning. Oddly, he was almost relieved that he wouldn't be going home until he'd had a chance to find out what was actually going on and, perhaps, find out if he should hand over the cursed leaflet to his superiors. But the briefing hadn't been very detailed and, according to rumor, the one policeman who'd made the mistake of admitting receipt of one of the leaflets had been hauled out of the station and interrogated by the SS. Hermann had quietly promised himself that he'd dump the leaflet he'd left at home as soon as he returned from work.
Get into your vans, the captain ordered curtly. Go.
Hermann hurried out of the station and clambered into the van, followed by a dozen other order policemen who were checking their pistols, truncheons, handcuffs, and radios as they readied themselves for the operation. There was no talking in the rear of the vehicle as the engine roared to life. They knew, all too well, that they might be running straight into an ambush. Hermann was old enough to remember the Gastarbeiter riots and the last gasps of the French resistance, when thousands of people, the innocent along with the guilty, had been rounded up and marched to the camps. The leaflet writers knew they couldn't expect mercy from the Reich. They'd be more likely to try to kill as many policemen as possible before being gunned down themselves. He shuddered inwardly as he checked his own weapons. The briefing had asserted that the leaflets had been spread by the Gastarbeiters, men and women who had come to Germany to work. It was unlikely a Gastarbeiter had actually written the leaflet. For once, Hermann was inclined to agree with the SS officer who'd briefed them. But that didn't absolve the Gastarbeiters of their role in the scheme. They should know better than to cross the authorities, he reminded himself. They had no rights, no legal protections, if a pure-blood German swore out a complaint against them. A Gastarbeiter who ran into trouble with the law would be lucky if he was only dispatched to the east and put to work building the giant autobahns that were slowly opening up eastern Russia to German settlements. The vehicle lurched violently as the driver turned on the siren, clearing civilian traffic out of their way as they drove into the suburbs. Hermann gritted his teeth. He preferred driving to sitting in the back of the van, and tried not to think about what might be lying in wait for them. But his thoughts kept straying to Gudrun, to the beautiful and clever daughter he didn't really understand. Marlena and Hannah, his sisters, had been content to marry well and become housewives, tending the house and bringing up a small flock of children, but Gudrun? She wanted to be something more, something masculine. Hermann would have forbidden her from attending the university, he knew now, if he'd realized just what it would do to her. She was trying to slip away from becoming a wife and mother and what? It would only bring her heartbreak. Hermann winced inwardly. There were few jobs for women in the Reich, particularly young and fertile women, who could have married and had children instead of trying to compete with the men. Gudrun's only real hope lay in computers, the strange devices imported from the United States, and even then, the big companies would be reluctant to hire a young girl who wasn't married. The only fields completely open to women were nursing and the never-to-be-sufficiently-damned BDM. He tried to imagine Gudrun as a BDM matron and shuddered at the thought. His daughter was too sweet, too caring, too compassionate to develop the sadism required of a matron. Gudrun would never bully young girls, he was sure. She'd never force overweight girls to stand in the center of the room and hold back tears as they were mocked by their fellows. The very thought was absurd. And if she graduated, he asked himself, who would want to marry her? It was an odd thought, but true. What sort of man would want to marry a woman who had more qualifications than himself? Gudrun might be doomed to permanent spinsterhood merely by having a useless scrap of paper, a qualification she couldn't use because she was a woman. Hermann had approved of Conrad. He didn't have the arrogance that typified SS stormtroopers. But would he still want Gudrun after she graduated? And what would she have done if Conrad had refused to allow her to work? It was his right, as her husband, to decide if his wife could work. What would Gudrun have done if he'd told her to stay at home and have his babies? I shouldn't have let her go to the university, he thought, as the vehicle lurched again. She will only think she can be more than a housewife. Caius tapped his shoulder.
We're going to be there in 2 minutes, he said. Wake up!
I wasn't sleeping, Hermann muttered as he sat upright.
The other policeman looked as tired and wary as he felt.
Are you ready?
They should have sent in the stormtroopers, Caius said. God knows what we might encounter.
Politics, Fritz said.
He had relatives in high places, Hermann had heard, although they clearly couldn't be bothered to boost Fritz's career.
They don't want to put the SS in complete control of the investigation.
Hermann fought down the urge to roll his eyes like a child. It was flatly illegal for a Gastarbeiter to own a gun, and gun control within the Reich was strict. But there had been a thriving trade in weapons shipped in from France and Russia for decades. They might just run into a terrorist cell with rifles and machine guns, and, as the terrorists would have nothing to lose, they'd sell their lives dearly. Putting the thought aside, he checked his pistol as the vehicle came to a halt, and then followed Fritz and Caius through the metal doors and into the cold morning air. The Gastarbeiter barracks were right in front of them, a pair of armed guards at the gatehouse, staring at the policeman in surprise.
Arrest them too, the captain ordered, and then get the Gastarbeiters under control.
Here we go, Caius commented.
Hermann gave him a sharp look as the armed policeman hurried through the gates and down towards the barracks. It was a solid building, reminding him of his military service. Indeed, the only real difference between the army barracks and the Gastarbeiter barracks was that there was only one set of doors, right at the front of the concrete building. The Gastarbeiters would have problems getting out if there was a fire, but no one really gave a damn about their safety. They were hired for grunt labor, nothing more. There was an infinite supply of Frenchmen and women who would come to work in the Reich, even though the pay was poor and the conditions were dreadful. Hermann wouldn't have given two rusty Reichmarks for their future. Vichy France wasn't about to complain if a few hundred Gastarbeiters were unceremoniously shipped east so they could be worked to death. They passed through a small office. The corporation that controlled the Gastarbeiters had a habit of hiring them out for private commissions, and opened the metal door that led into the barracks itself. Hermann wrinkled his nose at the smell of too many men in close proximity. The Gastarbeiters didn't have regular showers, unlike the men in his former unit, and then cocked his pistol as the Gastarbeiters jumped up, some of them cracking their heads on the upper bunks. Their eyes were wide with fear. Untermenschen, Hermann thought. He couldn't help noticing that some of the men were so poor they had to sleep in their work clothes, or in the nude, despite the cold. Many of them were scarred, suggesting they'd been whipped at some point in the non-too-distant past. He relaxed slightly as he realized there wouldn't be a fight. Men without the spirit to try to resist. "Get up!" the captain bellowed as the policemen spread out. "Hands in the air! Hands in the air!" Hermann watched, feeling his hands grow sweaty around his pistol. If there was going to be any resistance, it was going to be now. But the Frenchman showed no signs of being willing to fight. He smirked, remembering his father's story of how the Wehrmacht had marched through France, sowing their oats in the wombs of French maidens as they passed. His father had told him that Frenchmen were always cowards, and Hermann hadn't seen much in his military and police career to suggest differently. The captain barked more orders. Hermann, Caius, and Fritz got the job of stripping, handcuffing, and searching the Gastarbeiters one by one, while other policemen searched the barracks or headed off to find the corporate officials responsible for supervising the Gastarbeiters. There was no resistance, even when Hermann used a knife to remove clothes and pushed the prisoners out into the cold morning air, where they squatted on the ground and awaited their fate passively. The only moment of excitement came when a policeman found a small packet of German chocolates hidden within a bedroll, probably stolen from a German shop. Hermann was almost disappointed with the lack of action by the time the prisoner vans arrived from the station. The Gastarbeiters were herded into the vans, their hands still cuffed, and told to sit down. No one would care if they suffocated inside the vehicles before they reached the station.
"You'll be escorting them to the processing camp," the captain said. "The SS will take them from there."
"Understood," Hermann said.
He nodded to Caius and led the way to the nearest van, where they clambered up beside the driver. The stench of unwashed bodies was strong, despite the air conditioning. He forced himself to breathe through his mouth as the driver started the engine and drove back onto the streets. So early in the morning, there was almost no traffic in the suburbs. He smiled to himself as they drove past another set of barracks. They'd be having their own visits from the police soon enough, and then past one of the brothels. A handful of bleary-looking soldiers were staggering out of the door, clearly somewhat the worse for wear. The sight brought back happy memories of his own premarital days.
"They'll be in deep shit when they get back to the barracks," Caius predicted. "I bet you 10 Reichmarks they overslept in the arms of a whore or two."
"No bet," Hermann said.
His lips curved into a smile. Soldiers were allowed to slack off for a few weeks after Victory Day. It was why Kurt was still at home, rather than in the barracks with his unit. But there were limits. He suspected that some Oberfeldwebel would make them regret they'd ever been born after they staggered back through the barracks if they were lucky. Being officially charged with desertion would probably get them sent to a punishment battalion somewhere in the east.
"Approaching the camp," the driver said. "You want to get out first and check the prisoners?"
Hermann nodded as they passed through two sets of gates and came to a halt beside the entry building. A handful of SS stormtroopers were already waiting, one of them eyeing the police vehicles with barely concealed contempt. Hermann shook his head. There was little room for elegance in police transports, and clambered out of the cab, jumping down neatly to the hard concrete ground. The SS stormtrooper threw a sharp salute and nodded to the rear of the transport.
"These the Untermenschen?"
"Yes," Hermann said, as if regular prisoners were ever brought to the SS camps. "They're cuffed and naked."
The driver flicked a switch in the cab, unlocking the rear of the van. The SS troops threw open the doors, then recoiled at the stench. Several of the prisoners had fouled themselves, clearly convinced they were going to die. Others were lying on the floor, seemingly unconscious or dead. Hermann sighed inwardly. Dead prisoners would mean more paperwork when he got back to the station, and watched as the stormtroopers ordered the living prisoners to climb out of the van one by one. Naked, bound, they were prodded through the gates by rifle barrels and into the building, where they would be processed and then made to wait until their fates were decided.
Untermenschen, he thought again.
None of the prisoners seemed capable of offering even the slightest resistance, and a handful were crying.
There isn't a real man amongst them.
Caius elbowed him as another van passed through the gates and came to a halt.
You think we can slip back to the station once the prisoners are handed over?
We might have to wash out the van first, Hermann muttered resentfully.
Prisoners fouling themselves was not unusual, and no one really cared if a couple died on the way to the jail. But it wasn't as if they had to clean up the mess.
You just know who will inspect the vehicles this evening.
Caius opened his mouth to answer, then stopped and stared as the second van was opened and the prisoners marched into the camp. They were all women, as naked as the day they were born, their hands cuffed behind their backs. Hermann stared despite himself. They looked to be maids, young women hired to assist German housewives after they turned out their fourth child and earned the Mutterkreuz. Adelinda had flatly refused to allow one in her house, even though she was technically qualified to have one. Hermann didn't know if his wife feared he might fancy the girl, or if Adelinda's father would play games with her.
And what sort of message would it send to the children, he asked himself, if I played around with the maid right in front of their mother?
Untermenschen, the SS stormtrooper said. Such whores can never be good Germans.
Hermann nodded. It wasn't safe to disagree. Besides, back when he'd been in the military, there had been strict regulations banning relationships with Untermenschen women. He'd regarded them as a killjoy. Far too many other soldiers had felt the same way. But the Race Classification Bureau had made it clear that good German genes were not to be introduced to the Slavs. There were so many Slavs that even a small handful of German-Slav hybrids might allow them to fight and win a war against the Reich. He pushed the thought to the back of his mind as he scrambled back into the van, once the last of the girls was through the gates and into the processing center, and they were driven back to the station. He'd hoped for a break, but instead he was ordered to supervise a handful of German prisoners, the corporate officials who owned the Untermenschen, and watch as they were interrogated by the SS. Hermann couldn't help feeling a little sorry for them, even though they were unwilling participants in treason. They might be released if they weren't guilty of actually writing the damn leaflets themselves, but it would cast a long shadow over the rest of their lives. They would probably find themselves exiled to the east.
"Get a bite to eat," the captain said, when the last of the prisoners was finally escorted down to the cells and looked in, "and then report to my office in 30 minutes.
Hermann and Caius exchanged looks, then hurried down to the canteen and hastily ate a quick snack before heading back up to the captain's office. There were hardly any policemen in the corridors as they walked up the stairs. It looked very much as though most of the policemen attached to the station were out on the streets or supervising prisoners. Hermann shuddered inwardly at the thought of one of them searching his house. He reminded himself, again, to destroy the leaflet as soon as he returned home, and knocked on the captain's open door. The captain was sitting behind his desk, examining a set of folders, while Fritz was sitting in front of him.
"Come in," the captain said. "I have a specific job for you."
Hermann nodded and took the proffered seat. Caius sat next to him.
"We have not learned much," the captain said shortly. "The Gastarbeiters were apparently hired to hand out the leaflets by a person who remains unidentified. There are no pictures available of this individual, and the descriptions we have are so imprecise that it is impossible to narrow down the field. Most of the fingerprints on the leaflets belong to the Gastarbeiters or the Germans who handed them in. However, we may have had one lucky break. One of the fingerprints matched an individual on file."
Hermann leaned forward, feeling his heart starting to race. Fingerprints were not altogether reliable,
But if they'd matched one fingerprint to the files, they might just have caught the ringleader, and that would mean promotion.
Herr Dr. Professor Klaus Mürken, the captain said. He picked up one of the files and passed it to Hermann. Professor of Computer Studies at Albert Speer University.
Caius smiled.
And you want this man arrested, Herr Hauptmann?
I do, the captain confirmed. Arrest him and bring him to the station now.
Chapter 18. Albert Speer University, Berlin. 29 July, 1985. Gudrun had been relieved when she'd woken up and discovered, as she helped her mother make breakfast, that her father had had to stay at the station overnight. It wasn't common. Her father normally worked from 9 till 5 and then headed straight home. But it was a relief. Kurt might have spoken to their father for her, yet she'd been dreading their next meeting. Walking out of the house, carrying her bag of university books, had left her with the sensation that she was escaping a destiny mapped out by someone else. By the time she reached the university itself, she felt almost as if there was nothing she couldn't do. Horst met her by the gates.
"There's a lot of chatter," he said, as Gudrun flushed with embarrassment. She'd kissed him, and she would have gone further if he'd let her. "Just remember to be careful what you say."
"Of course," Gudrun said a little tartly. Part of her would have been relieved if she'd never seen Horst again, even though she was sure he wouldn't tell anyone about the kiss. But she needed to ask him and the others why the leaflets had been distributed far more widely than she'd expected.
"Can we sneak up to the meeting room?"
"Better to wait for a while," Horst said, as they stepped through the gates. "The entire university is buzzing."
He was right, Gudrun discovered. Students were talking in small groups about the leaflets, comparing notes about soldiers who'd gone to South Africa and dropped out of contact, fathers, brothers, and friends who seemed to have vanished. Gudrun listened, careful not to say too much, as the chatter grew stronger. Hundreds of students, it seemed, were realizing for the first time that they'd been told lies by the state. And the more they compared notes, the clearer the picture became.
"They can't arrest everyone," she told herself.
She had no idea if that was actually true, but there were over 2,000 students in the university itself, all with friends and family who would be upset if they were arrested.
"They can't take us all away, can they?"
She shuddered, remembering Grandpa Frank's words. The Reich had slaughtered untold millions, perhaps billions, of human beings, men and women who weren't so different from the Germans themselves. It was a crime so vast as to be almost beyond her comprehension, an atrocity so staggering that it would be easy to believe it had never happened. And yet, reading between the lines, it was clear that it had happened. Grandpa Frank might have told her what he'd seen, but she'd read the books and noted carefully what they didn't say.
"My father wasn't too pleased," she muttered to Horst. "He was demanding to know when I'd get married and out of his house."
Horst shrugged. "Fathers are like that," he said. "Mine certainly told me I'd be expected to marry as soon as I decently could, no matter what I did with my life."
Gudrun shook her head tiredly as they made their way to the classrooms. Conrad was unlikely to recover, but her father didn't know that. Not yet. As long as he thought she was engaged to Conrad, or close to engaged, he wouldn't insist that she looked for another suitable husband. But once he found out the truth, he would tell her to find someone or to allow him to suggest potential candidates. Her stomach turned at the thought of who her father would consider suitable. A boring man, she was sure, a man who'd want a housewife and nothing more. And her father would keep shoving candidates at her until she gave in. She looked at Horst thoughtfully. He was handsome enough, she supposed. Strong, smart. He'd have to be to get into the university. And all too aware of what she was doing instead of studying. Marriage to him wouldn't be too bad, but she'd have to go to the East once she finished her studies, unless he decided to stay in the West with her. She opened her mouth to ask him what he'd do, then dismissed the thought.
It was unlikely in the extreme that they'd live long enough to get married and make a future together. Horst gave her an odd look.
Are you all right?
It's just the excuse, Gudrun lied. They'd called their periods the excuse in the BDM. Horst frowned, then blushed with embarrassment. Gudrun couldn't help smiling despite her own embarrassment. Conrad had affected a selective deafness whenever female issues were mentioned.
I'll be better soon, I'm sure.
I'm sure of it, Horst agreed. He gave her a bland smile. Gudrun, I...
He broke off as a rustle ran through the students behind them. Gudrun turned and saw a trio of green-clad order policemen making their way through the crowd, their mere presence parting the students as effectively as Moses had parted the Red Sea. Horst caught her arm and gently pulled her out of the way, slipping down a side corridor as the policemen walked past their position. Gudrun tensed as she realized one of them was her father. Had he come to look for her? Or had he been called to the university on other business?
That's my father, she breathed.
Panic started to bubble up within her mind.
Horst.
Remain calm, Horst whispered.
Students were scattering in all directions, unwilling to risk doing anything that might draw attention from the policeman.
Just.
He looked around, then drew her into an alcove.
We need to see what they're doing here, he added at her bemused look. Or do you want to run and hide?
Gudrun, stung, drew herself up to her full height.
If he's here for me, she said, is there any point in hiding?
Probably not, Horst said after a moment. But if he was here for you, why would he bring two of his friends?
Hermann had never set foot in the university before, not even when Gudrun had been accepted as a student. Parents weren't meant to supervise their children's education, and while the university had thrown out many traditions, it had made sure to keep that one. Indeed, Hermann had only visited his children's schools after the teachers had complained about their behavior. Kurt had often been in trouble for fighting, and Johann, it seemed, was going the same way.
Good for him, Hermann thought, as he made his way through the corridors.
He'd never been in the building before, but there were helpful signs everywhere.
A fighter is better than a coward.
The university struck him as odd. It was nothing like a school. Indeed, the mandatory portraits of Hitler and the Reich cabinet were at a bare minimum, while the walls were covered with bright maps, abstract paintings that looked as though someone had splashed ink randomly on paper, and photographs of spacecraft, space stations, and the tiny base on the moon. Kurt had wanted to be an astronaut, Hermann recalled. He'd been disappointed for weeks after he failed to get into the Air Force, the first step towards flying into space. Johann had been talking about being the first man on Mars, too.
And this place is where they design the next generation of spacecraft, he thought, as he paused in front of a drawing of a massive space rocket.
It looked too big to be realistic, unless there was something special about the rocket drive. The tiny image of a teenage boy, a sea captain, and a bald professor at the bottom caught his eye for a long moment. Maybe Johann will fly that rocket into space. He pushed the thought aside as they walked on until they reached the computer labs and stepped through the door. Inside there were 50 computers lined up in neat rows, dozens of students sitting in front of them tapping on keyboards. Their eyes went wide as they saw the policeman, guilt written all over their faces. Hermann smirked inwardly. Everyone, it seemed, remembered guilty secrets when they saw a policeman, and raked the room with his eyes, searching for Herr Dr. Professor Klaus Merkin. The professor was standing behind a female student. Hermann was irrationally grateful it wasn't Gudrun, one hand resting on her shoulder as he explained something to her.
Herr Dr. Professor Klaus Merkin, he said, as the policeman stepped forward.
Merkin didn't look dangerous, but they had strict orders to bring him in alive and relatively unharmed.
You are under arrest.
Merkin's eyes widened in shock. He offered no resistance as he was roughly searched and his hands were cuffed behind his back. Hermann had been curious to discover what a professor of computer studies might carry in his pockets. He'd tried reading one of Gudrun's books and found it completely beyond his understanding. But Merkin wasn't carrying anything apart from a pair of pencils, an American-made pocket calculator, and a tiny device Hermann couldn't identify. He bagged everything, then nodded to Fritz and Caius, who frog-marched the professor through the door and out into the corridor. Hermann braced himself as they marched past a number of students. Many of them had their faces frozen in the expressionless masks they learned as children, when showing the wrong emotion could lead to a beating or worse. But a number were staring in horror and hatred, even though it could be dangerous. Hermann was tempted to snap and snarl at them as they passed, or drag them in for interrogation, yet he knew it would be pointless. Instead, he merely ignored the students, counting on their uniforms to clear a pathway for them. It worked. No one barred their way as they half-carried the shocked professor through the corridors and out through the gates. They'd get Merkin back to the station, where the SS would interrogate him harshly.
"I didn't do anything," Merkin said. "I didn't."
"I'm sure," Hermann snapped.
He felt a flicker of guilt as they walked past a pair of female students, both of whom stared in horror. Merkin wasn't big enough to justify carrying him around like a drunken soldier, but he knew they had no choice.
"The SS will be the judge of that."
Gudrun had liked Professor Merkin. He was always friendly, always willing to explain some of the more difficult concepts and, unlike some of the other professors, never seemed willing to assume that a girl was automatically nowhere near as capable as a boy. She'd hoped he'd tutor her when she entered her second year of computer studies. But now, her father and two burly policemen were carrying him out of the university in cuffs. She felt sick as she watched them go by, her father bringing up the rear. She shrank back into the shadows as they passed, hoping and praying that her father didn't see her.
"They came and took the professor," she thought numbly.
She'd half expected to be arrested herself, or to watch helplessly as some of her friends were marched away. She'd never expected to see Professor Merkin arrested by her father.
"Why did they arrest him?"
"They arrested him," she muttered, once the policemen were out of earshot.
If her father had seen her, and he might have done, he'd show no sign of it.
"Why did they arrest him?"
"I don't know," Horst muttered back. "But we'd better get into class."
Gudrun gave him a nasty look as they made their way down the corridor.
"How can you be so calm?"
"There's nothing to be gained by panicking," Horst pointed out. "The professor knows nothing, and he's quite valuable, so I'm sure he will be released soon enough."
"I hope you're right," Gudrun said. "But if you're wrong..."
She left the thought unfinished. They'd poked the authorities in their collective eye, and now they were angry. Her father might be the face of authority, and he had complete authority over her and her siblings. But he wouldn't be the one making the real decisions, not after her little group had embarrassed the entire state. The Reich Council would be angry and humiliated and... And who knew what they'd do? They might consider the professor an acceptable scapegoat for the leaflets, or they might genuinely believe that he'd been involved in the plot.
"And we sent copies of the leaflets through the computer network," she thought, as her blood ran cold. "They might well have good reason to blame the professor."
Classes, not entirely to her surprise, were a joke. The professors were clearly nervous. The students were chattering away in small groups, telling one another what they'd seen when the policeman had entered the university. Gudrun did her best to keep her head down by reading her book, waiting for a chance to meet up with her friends after lunch. The professor dismissed class early, to her mingled dismay and relief. They'd learned nothing, and they had exams coming up in a matter of months. "Not that exams will matter that much," she thought, as they ate lunch and headed for the study room. "If we get caught, I'll be lucky if I get exiled to the east."
"They must have taken the professor's fingerprint from one of the leaflets," Horst said, once the door was closed and the bug was neutralized by bad American music. "He was the one who loaded the printer, I suspect.
They took his fingerprint and assumed it was one of ours. Gudrun swallowed.
Is there anything we can do about that?
Not unless you want to be arrested yourself, Sven said. We should just count ourselves lucky that the professor knows nothing.
But he's innocent, Gudrun protested.